Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, the Arab world meets Europe, a reading and conversation with Elias Khoury, Global Distinguished Professor of Middle Eastern and Arabic Studies at New York University. Our talk is presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe and is co-sponsored by the Institute for Iraqi Studies, the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations, the Middle East and North African Studies Program, and the literary journal Agni. Tonight's moderator is Jocelyn Cicere, Professor of Religion and Politics at the University of Birmingham, UK, and Senior Research Fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center on Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Professor of Anthropology and International Relations, Dr. Richard Norton.
Elias Khoury was born in Beirut, and as a young man, one of the sort of formative moments in his life was the 1967 war, which really reshaped the vision of many young Arabs and older Arabs growing up in the 1960s. While he is a Christian, he's not a man of sectarianism, and in fact, I think it's fair to say that his indictment of the Lebanese political system is one that, that at its core argues about, if you will, the poison of a system based on sex. When people think about the Lebanese Civil War, which went on from 1975 to 1990, sometimes they think about it as a war between Christians and Muslims, but that wasn't really the case at all. It was a war really between sects, and it was very much a regional war, and a war which would not have been possible if not because of the divisions that that separate Lebanese. He's the author of 13 novels, 4 volumes of literary criticism, 3 plays. He's been awarded numerous prizes, including the Palestine Prize for the next-to-last book that was published in English. That book was also named Best Book of the Year by Le Monde Diplomatique, the Christian Science Monitor, the San Francisco Chronicle, and singled out as a notable book by the New York Times. And of course, his newest book, Broken Mirrors, is of equal distinction, I would argue. Our speaker is a global distinguished professor of Middle Eastern and Arabic Studies at NYU, and also the winner, I should have mentioned, of the French, the inaugural French Prize for an Arab novel. So really a man of extraordinary distinction, praised by many of the great intellectual figures in the Arab world of the last decades, Edward Said, Adunis, and so on. We'll also hear a commentary from Jocelyn Cicere, who is a professor of religion and politics at the University of Birmingham, UK, and also a simultaneously senior research fellow at Georgetown University, Berkeley Center on Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. In addition, she teaches on contemporary Islam at the Harvard Divinity School and directs the Harvard Interdisciplinary Program on Islam in the West. She's also the author of a number of books, notably The Islamic Awakening from Cambridge University Press in 2014, Why the West Fears Islam, published in 2013, and a 2006 book, which remains important, When Islam and Democracy Meet Muslims in Europe and the United States. So I'm very pleased to leave the floor to our two distinguished participants tonight, Elias Khoury and Jocelyn Cicere. Please join me in welcoming them.
Thank you for this generous introduction. Thank you for this giving me the possibility to meet all of you and to speak about my new book in English. Actually, this is not my new book. My new book came out in Arabic last month, but you know it needs another 2-3 years to be translated. So when you are in translation, you have to speak about an old book, pretending that it's a new one. So I will pretend that this is my new book, which is not the case. And I will read to you some fragments from it in English. The novel is entitled "The Broken Mirrors," Sin Alcohol, and actually it's a story which takes place in Beirut in 1989-1990, which was supposed to be the year when the Lebanese Civil War ended. And as you will see when you read the book, that one of the hypotheses of the main character of this book is that the war did not end. And actually the war did not end, the war is still continuing, but in different forms. And now when we look backwards to the Lebanese war, for me it seems as if it was a general rehearsal for the wars that are taking place in Lebanon. You see, history is very cynical, and it shows us its meanings later. When we were part of this war, we didn't realize that we were not only a battlefield for a regional war, but that we are the preparation for the real regional civil wars that are destroying the Arab Levant, and that are creating one of the most, maybe the biggest human tragedy in the world after World War II, which is the Syrian tragedy. Now, but of course, I'm only a storyteller. I'm not a politician. I'm only a storyteller, and I like to hear stories and to tell stories. And actually, the stories that I tell, most of the time I hear them. So don't believe writers that they have inspirations. We have little inspirations and a lot of work. And the major work is to travel towards the others and to travel in order to hear the others and in order to represent what is not represented normally in the dominant ideological field. And to speak about the marginals in our society that can show us the reality of these societies, and that can also take us to the depth of the tragedy and of the human experience as such. Now, you know, in English, when you tell a story, you begin by this sentence, "Once upon a time." In Arabic, we don't say "once upon a time." In Arabic, we say "kan ya makan," which means "it was" or "it was not." That's to say that what you will be hearing is real, and it can be irreal, and it can be imaginary. So the imagination will become real, and the real will become imagination. And this is the genius of 1001 Nights, which is the source of inspiration, not only to Arab writers, but I think to the writers of the whole world. The genius is how to make the reality looks like imaginary, because that's how it is, and the imaginary takes the shape of reality. So this is what actually I've been trying to do all through my career, as my life, not career, it is not a career, my life as a writer. Try to put together this combination in books. Now, this book I will be reading from is a story about a father and his two sons. They come from East Beirut, that is from the Christian part of the city, and they are twins and not twins because they were born in the same year. But one was born in January and the other was born in December. And the father was so proud of himself that he could make two children in the same year, which is something very, very... And the father was a pharmacist, a very interesting... an old man in the novel. For me, he was a very interesting figure of a combination of madness, cynicism, and detachment from what was taking place. And his two sons, one of them was a student of medicine at the American University of Beirut. He was a very good student. And the other one was, the younger one, was a very bad student. He never continued his studies. But they were very similar. But the war came and separated them. The big brother will become a leftist, and he will work with the Palestinian movement. And the young brother will become a Falangist, which is the Christian Fascist Party. And so their ways will be totally separated. And the big one, like, he was an intellectual, and as you know, all intellectuals are cowards. So in the middle of the civil war, he will leave Lebanon to go and continue his studies and to work as a medical doctor in Montpellier in France, whereas the young son will stay in Beirut. And the paradox of the relationship is that the big brother had a girlfriend whom he left in Beirut, and this girlfriend will become the wife of the young brother. And the novel will take place when the young brother will invite his brother to come back to Beirut, his big brother to come back to Beirut, and because because he was a member of the militia and he stole a lot, like all these big names of the militias, and he's very rich now, and he was suggesting to his brother that he will build for him a hospital. So the big brother will leave Montpellier to come to Beirut for several months, and in Beirut all the shadows of the war will haunt him, and the whole project will fail, and that's it. So I told you the story, so you don't need to read the book. Of course you need to read the book. There's nothing. I mean, literature is not what's the story and what will happen if they will marry in the end, like when we're kids. The story is about the way it's told. The story, the book is about the way it's written, and how stories come out from other stories to create this magical field, which actually astonishes me as a writer. Hopefully, it will astonish you as readers. So I will be reading a very short part of the novel, and then we will have the conversation, and then I will be glad to reply or just to hear your comments and your questions. Bismillah. It's page 24. When Karim Shammas is the big brother. When Karim Shammas agreed to return to Beirut for the hospital construction project, he didn't know that the civil war, which had come to an end in Lebanon, would begin anew within him. The war will never end, Mrs. Salma had said to him when she saw him in front of his father's pharmacy on Zahrat al-Ahsan Street in Beirut. When he'd seen the woman who covered her head with a black silk scarf coming out of the pharmacy, he had wanted to run, but instead remained rooted to the spot. The woman, who was in her 50s, approached him, gave him a contemptuous look, and asked him why he was going to France and leaving his fiancée behind. He said he'd never been officially engaged to Hind, and was tired of the war, and couldn't take it anymore. I'll come back when the war's over, he said. The war will never end, because it's inside us, said the woman. She folded her arms over her chest, bowed her head, and went her way. And Selma was right. The pretty widow, as his father called her, had said the war would never end, and has entreated him to remain in Beirut. He didn't remember exactly what she'd said. Had she asked why he was leaving his fiancée, or why he wasn't taking her with him? Hind had told him she didn't want him. She hadn't said exactly that, but she'd said she'd never go abroad and leave her mother alone in Beirut. The problem had begun a long time before, as the love that had lasted 4 years began to evaporate. To be honest, I have no idea who you are. How can I live with a man I know nothing about? But you know everything. Everything means nothing, she said. As Hind was right, everything had turned into nothing. He'd reached Montpellier, joined the university and its associated hospital, and the picture of her he'd placed on the table next to his bed had become a burden. He decided to put it in a drawer where it stayed. When he finished his studies and moved from the dormitory to his new apartment, he'd left the picture in the drawer by mistake. Or remembering it a week later, he felt an obscure nostalgia that was swallowed up in a roar of laughter. Bernadette had told him he used his loud laugh to hide his shyness and weakness, but he hadn't understood. He thought his resounding laugh was an expression of his strong personality. That was what he'd felt during the only battle he'd fought in at Nahr el-Bared camp near Tripoli when he was 19. He'd been in a trench opposite the mound occupied by the Lebanese army, holding a Kalashnikov, with Nabil Abu Halqa lying on his stomach next to him, holding one of those big belt-fed machine guns that they call a Dekhtiryov to cover his comrade. Suddenly, the bullets flew. This was nothing like the training course that Karim had taken, which has lasted fewer than 10 days and hadn't taught him how to identify the source of fire or draw up a plan to confront a possible attack on his position. Instead, he'd found himself firing widely and laughing out loud and not noticing that his colleague's gun had fallen silent. When the firing stopped as suddenly as it had started, he turned to his comrade and found him sitting bent over, moaning with pain. When Nabil announced to him that he could hold on no longer and that he had to empty his bowels, Karim burst out laughing again. "You mean you f***ed yourself, you coward. Get up, get up. I can smell it." But Nabil, shaking with fear, said he didn't dare leave the trench and was so afraid of the snipers he'd had to shit right where he was. "The smell's everywhere," yelled Karim. "At least cover it. Cover it over. Cats are better than you." He burst out laughing. Nabil would die years later in the battles of the commercial souks, his comrade recounting that he died because of his reckless courage, while Karim, after the experience at Nahr el-Bared, hadn't dared to take arm, but a symbolic part in the fighting. That thought is another story. Instead of replying to his French wife that he was laughing because he didn't care, "And if you don't care, nothing can frighten you," he burst out laughing and said nothing. Everything had turned into nothing. Hind had entered a hidden space called forgetting and had only been reawoken the day his brother Nassim failed to tell him he'd married her but hadn't invited Karim to the wedding because Hind had refused to allow any celebrations. She wouldn't even agree to invite her mother and your father. He hadn't roared with laughter that day. That day, he'd felt shocked, and a strange feeling had come over him. It was as if Nassim had stolen his life from him, as though by staying there in Beirut, he'd taken the city from him. On top of that, the political choices of the two brothers had intervened. The younger become sole inheritor of the house and pharmacy, while it had it had become impossible for Karim to return to the east side of Beirut where the Falangists ruled. Then after the savage assassination of Khaled Nabulsi, he'd found he couldn't breathe. The air had been cut off in Beirut, and he'd felt he was breathing not air but thorns. So he decided to leave and never come back. Everything inside him had died, and he no longer cared. He'd phoned Hind, who had come and sat before him in silence at Uncle Sam's, close to the American University in Beirut, listening to his sudden decision and saying she wouldn't go with him because she couldn't leave her mother. Her mother, Salma, however, had a different perspective. She'd looked at him with contempt and said the war would never end because it came from inside of us. Where did she get such eloquence? And who was this woman who had so nearly been his mother-in-law? Hind had said her mother wanted her and her son-in-law to live at home with her because she couldn't bear to live alone. But it's still too soon, Karim said. I know, my mother's a bit childish. She abandoned me when I was young, and now she wants to cling to me for the rest of her life. Obviously, I don't want that, but I haven't the heart. We haven't agreed to get married yet, said Karim. We haven't agreed. You are right. We haven't talked about it, but you know I love you and you love me. She had told him she loved him and wanted him just when what he called the oil of desire had started to run out. Beirut had disappeared under the shelling, and this girl had taken the thread of chastity in her hand as though something had awoken inside her and turned her into something like a wife. Which was the real Hind? When he'd held her in his arms for the first time, she trembled like a small bird. They were at her apartment, and her mother wasn't there. It was the eve of Good Friday. The voice of Fairuz was rambling from the radio. Let your son's death be life for those who seek it. And Hind was listening on the verge of tears. He sat down next to her, saying nothing, but listening to the Requiem for Christ. He lit a cigarette, felt the singer's voice covering him in blue velvet, and had a vision of himself bending over Hind and taking her. She flowed like water, and Fairuz's velvet blended with Hind's face, which was covered in dew. He held her to him, and everything is inside him shattered. They were sitting now in the same cafe, drinking orange juice, while she talked to him about her mother, and he couldn't understand how she could say, I haven't the heart to leave her. After all the stories that she told him about her childhood at the half-time boarding school and her unshakable feeling that her mother was living somewhere else, he took hold of her hand, and she looked around as she withdrew it. You mustn't. Any moment someone will see us. Why hadn't she said they mustn't? Why hadn't she said they mustn't earlier? When, uncaring, she'd looked for opportunities to be alone with him, even discovering dark side streets before he found himself clasped as he walked with her. He told her he was leaving and had taken her hand, which she withdrew without speaking. So he understood that she understood that their love was gone. But he was wrong. He discovered his mistake here in Beirut when he heard her say her husband had never forgiven her, even though I was a virgin, as you know. Every time he sleeps with me, I feel as though there is something in his eyes he wants to say but doesn't. But he knows, said Karim. Did you tell him? She asked. Kind of, but it's not important. The day he'd taken her hand and she hadn't withdrawn it or said you mustn't, she'd let her hand flow and he listened to the voice of Fairuz and thought some memories were like tears. Why had she spoken of her mother? Who was this woman whom he had to meet at his brother's apartment the moment he arrived to Beirut? Hind had told him his mother's story many times, her mother's story many times, but each time he was amazed. He found it difficult to believe this story of a woman in the village of Khirbet al-Rahib in the Akkar district who had left her husband and three children and run away to Beirut to marry the agricultural engineer Sami Naqash. Salma's story was full of mystery. She'd met the engineer when he came to work on land reclamation in Akkar and had lost her head. This was what she said, what she had told her daughter. He spoke to me and I lost my head. This was, I, poor thing, was just a child. I was 21 and he was 40. Tall, his head shining with white hair, dark-skinned, with a bewitching smile and laughing eyes. He saw me walking on the road. I was carrying Mukhtar, my baby son, may God make his life easy, and he stopped and looked at me and smiled. I felt as though I had been paralyzed. Then I understood that that's what love is. Thank you.
I'm not a literary critic, so I'm not going to get into the whole remarkable aspect of this book that I read and I enjoyed very much. And it's called Broken Mirrors, and it's actually an assemblage, we say in French, or a mosaic of different narrative, broken narrative. So it's really like you look at a mirror that has been crushed, and you take the story from different angles and perspectives, and that's what is absolutely remarkable, not in an intellectual sense, but really in an emotional sense. And this story advanced through different back and forth and different perspectives at the same time. And it's a great, I would say, command of Arabic and English. Your translator in English also has, I think, done
a great job.
So all the figures are formidable, but I have to say, personally, I was very impressed by the father. You said he's detached and maybe cynical, probably, but he's also strong. I find him stronger than the generation of his sons. And also,
fathers are always better. I'm now a father.
I'm not sure it's only a question. I don't think it's a question of being a father. He is rooted in something that is very moving for his sons, you know. And all his interaction with them about the war is absolutely fascinating to me. So there is also, and I cannot get into that, but all the women in the story, they also are different part of, you know, what is to be a woman in this particular society, and it's also very very touching and emotional at a different level. But I would like to focus on two points, because after all I am a scholar of religion and politics, so I cannot do the literary critic too much. And I would like to talk about Lebanon and also the immigration theme that comes, and that may be secondary, but because I work a lot on Muslims, immigrants in different contexts, and also in Europe, I wanted to say a few words on that. So what is very strong across the whole novel is this impressionist depiction of Beirut. Beirut is never depicted as such, and that's the strength of the book. But through all these different broken narratives, you see, and through different situations and protagonists, you see the emergence of Beirut, and then the whole background, the political background of Lebanon. And here, the strongest point, and for me, having having known the story and having also friends in Lebanon, what was very strong is to assert through the point of view of Karim, but also Nassim and Selma that you just read, the civil war never ended. And in this regard, it's interesting because if you look only at the what I call the historiography, you know, the story that comes in textbooks, it's all about the states and institutions. So all the time you have war, the war ends because there is an agreement or a treaty, and we take for granted that because there is such an end of war, the peace is there. But it's not peace for the simple reason that some would call this negative peace. I don't know if it's the right term, but it means that the end of the war doesn't mean peace if people have not made, I would say, peace with themselves and peace with the others. And that's exactly what the book describes, this challenge to make peace with yourself and peace with the situations in you which you have been. And that's the whole challenge here, and that's what sometimes narratives and fiction work better than social analysis, because this is viewed from the point of view of Lebanese themselves, of flesh and blood of different in different parts of the of this mosaic or spectrum also. And what is very important is to see that the personal identifications are fluid, which again, if you look only at the institutional aspect, you would see sectarian division or community boundaries, while all the characters in this book, and it's true in the Lebanese society, do not stick by their religious or ethnic affiliation. And I think it's very important to see this divide, and that's why I think the gap here is an important one, and then the privilege or predominance of the political view or institutional point of view tend to overshadow this fluidity of identities of people. And what is not in the book, but that has a central role and responsibility, is the state. And this is not a book on the state, which I like very much because I work too much on the state, usually. But it's there in terms of shadow and its incapacity or unwillingness to move away from negative peace to real peace. If you think, I mean, again, there is no common textbook, history textbooks in Lebanon since the end of the civil war. So it is also a way to maintain and to reinforce the sectarian divide, you know. And so the sectarian divide is there, but it's part of a political chess game. It doesn't automatically restitute or reflect the reality of people, even though, I have to say, and it's also clear in the different characters, all the people are prisoners of that. Where are we moving here? Where are we moving from this sectarian divide toward a greater fluidity, not only in the person, but also in the political affiliation and institutionalization of democracy? But I want to open the discussion with you on one point, which is, so it's negative peace, so it's fragile, and that's what you said by referring also to the current context and the war in Syria, indeed, in which Lebanon is involved. So we see with the current situation a convergence of features that were already present in the civil war of the 70s and 80s, which is first the importance of external factor, you know, like in the book it's about Palestinians. Now it would be, you know, I would like to ask you about the refugees, the Syrian refugees in Lebanon. I work a lot in Europe. I spend a lot of time in Europe. The whole discourse is about refugees. Nobody is talking about the number of refugees in Lebanon and Turkey. These are also very important issues that are not even addressed as such. Not in Europe, but not even in the U.S. when they look at the question of refugees or when we look at the question of refugees there. And so knowing what happened with the Palestinian refugees in the 80s, what is your take here about you know, the capacity of Lebanon to accept all these refugees, and what are the consequences for the future of Lebanese democracy and sectarian divides. And also, all the book is about the tension between Christians and Muslims, and it seems to me that today the tensions are, at least in the war, not in the people involved in the book, but today, would you agree that the tension is more between Sunni and Shia? And especially you mentioned the role of Lebanon in the war in Syria today. And so what does it mean for Lebanon to be drawn into this Sunni-Shia tension that is beyond Syria and that is pervading across the whole region? Briefly, on the second theme, the immigration theme, I was very interested by the figure because this Dr. Karim doesn't have any socioeconomic issues of integration in France. He belongs to the upper class. He is married to a French woman. There is no class or economic issue. But even though you see, I think it's very well-rounded, this kind of incapacity to be completely member or part of this new society. It reminds me something the philosopher George Simmel wrote a long time ago, distinguishing the foreigner from the stranger. The foreigner is someone who is obviously, explicitly out for different reasons, including nationality, citizenship, work. The stranger is someone who is inside but is still not completely part of the community, and I think Karim is a stranger, and so this brings me to the question of Muslims today in Europe. They have socioeconomic challenges that Karim doesn't have. They have also educational challenges. And you add the religion. And so some of the kids, children of the third generation, or the first generation that were foreigners, are now strangers. And they feel this strangeness very, very strongly. Not for reasons that are accumulated. And so just to show you that socioeconomy is not always the solution for integration here. And we tend, I'm not saying that the socioeconomic problems are not important, but we tend to forget what I call sometimes the symbolic integration or the emotional integration. And I think very little is done in Europe to address this question as such, independently of religion or ethnicity or class. And that's what I would like to stop here and give you maybe the...
Oh, my God, you think these are questions?
Yes.
No.
Oh my God. No.
First of all, thank you for the literary analysis of the novel, of the book. Although you said that you are not in literary criticism, I think you can begin
a new career.
Yeah, you can be a very good literary critic. And thank you very much for your remarks, which actually entered the profound. Parts of the experience in this book, and then of course, here in this book I'm only a storyteller. Now I'm supposed to become something else, right?
Yeah, I know.
Okay, and you know, all of us are what we are, and we are someone else's. So this is the whole idea of identity. We don't have one identity. So I'm a storyteller. This is what I love most: to be a storyteller, and then to put all the contradictions together, all the points of views together, and to pretend that I do not have a position. The other part of me is I'm the so-called public intellectual. I'm a university professor, and of course, I will speak now on this part of myself, not on the story, because. Now, to speak about, you have raised many, 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 many questions, actually, which I don't know if we have time to answer, but I will try to answer, and then you'll find out if you want to make them more precise. You began actually with the problem of the refugees And of course, the problem of the refugees is becoming a huge problem in Europe. This is why it's becoming an international big problem. Because it was a big problem in Lebanon, in Turkey, and in Jordan. But it was not an international problem. Because we are, you know, we are. You know, these Arabs are killing Arabs. Like, you know, when the Israelis engineered the massacre of Sabra and Shatila in 1982, Menachem Begin, who was the prime minister of Israel, he said, Goyim are killing Goyim, as if the Israelis had nothing to do. So if the Goyims are killing Goyims, if the Arabs are killing Arabs, then khalas, no problem, because it's better if they kill each other for the civilized societies. But actually, this problem of refugees in Europe makes me really astonished. There are in Europe something like 120,000 refugees only. In Lebanon, we are 3.5 million Lebanese to 4 million, and we have 1.5 million refugees. And okay, it's tough. We have our voices, racist voices. You have everything in Lebanon, but they are there. And we live with them, and we have to make our way with them. Whereas in all of Europe cannot take 1 million refugees. I remember last year I was in Poland, in Warsaw, and I had a novel which was published in Polish, Yalo, which was published in England in English a long time ago. And we were having a debate it was in a book fair, and then someone jumped and told me that he is Polish, and he wants to ask me a question because they in Poland are thinking of giving refuge to 200 Syrian refugees. They are thinking. And I am quoting, we are a homogeneous society, so we want all of them to be Christians. What do you think, sir? I told them, look, Habibi, if you are a homogeneous society, you must be ashamed, because you became a homogeneous society after 3 million Jews were massacred. So you must not be proud of that. I'm sorry for you because you are a homogeneous society. So this idea, this madness, Europe must adapt to minorities. Europe actually finished all its minorities in the Second World War. If you take France, for example, I'm not speaking now about Arabs. In France, the Breton disappeared. There was a language which is called Breton. The Basque disappeared. All the minorities, the French, they are Christians. They disappeared. And then they come and give us lessons in human rights. But nonetheless, never mind. Now they have to accept the fact, first of all, the Muslim immigration to Europe did not begin with the Civil War. It began a long time ago, and they needed the immigrant workers because they were not making children. And they needed people to work. And now they are facing the fact that, once again, they have to understand that there is multicultural situations and to adapt to that and stop bringing to us Marine Le Pen or your Trump to trump us with all this this terrible discourse. Now, in Lebanon, of course, it's a big problem. It's a big problem because Lebanon is a very poor country. And we were having some money from our Arab brothers, who now are very angry. Saudi Arabia is very angry. And you know, the Saudis are a very democratic regime. You know, the last elections that happened in Saudi Arabia took place directly after the death of Prophet Muhammad. The only elections. So they are giving us lessons nonetheless. And now we're a poor country. We have 1 million and they have refugees. We don't know, and then we have a racist problem in Lebanon because we are in a confessional society, in a confessional political system, not society.
Yeah.
And a confessional is by definition racist, because I'm a Christian, so I have to hate the other because he's a Muslim, which is racism. This is the definition of racism. So the racism in Lebanon took the shape against the Syrians, which was mingled with the confessional problem, because of course the Syrians are Muslims, are Sunni Muslims, so the Christians are afraid, and the Shiites are afraid, because now the Sunnis are the vast majority if we put the Syrians with us. So this is a big problem which the Lebanese society is adapting to it, not solving it. We are a society that adapts, even to garbage. And I'm not comparing, but it's of course the Syrians are our brothers, and I have devoted a lot of writings about Syria to the extent that people who thought first that I was a Palestinian now think that I'm Syrian. And the political system, which is built upon about this confessional structure, when we speak about confessional structure, it's not the problem of religion. It's mostly a political problem, because all the political structure of confessional system is only possible if the different confessional political structures are related to a foreign country. The Christians were the first, practically the first real confessional system, because it was created in the 19th century, and the Christians, especially the Catholic Christians, had this phantasm that they were French. So they were totally linked to the colonial politics of Europe, of mainly France. Shiism, political Shiism, only occurred after the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and after Iran became a regional power. Then the Shiism has its special relationship with the Iranians, and has money from the Iranians, of course, and arms from the Iranians. This is why they are becoming, the structure is becoming very powerful. The Sunni community was never a confession till the end of the civil war, when our Syrian brothers invaded our country and destroyed us with their army. Actually, now during the civil war, we understand that in Lebanon they were very tolerant compared to what the Assad has done to the Syrian people. But nonetheless, and what we call the Sunni confessional structure became only possible when Saudi Arabia decided to become a regional power, because the real regional power, which is Egypt, is outside the map, outside the political map. So practically, a system like this, which cannot make peace, because it's not a local, it's not a national system. The political decision is abroad. The leader, everybody, you know, we hear that Hassan Nasrallah made a declaration, let's hear him. Actually, Nasrallah do not decide. He cannot decide. All his structure is Iranian. And of course, when we hear Mr. Hariri speaking, we think that he's deciding. He cannot decide, because the decision is Saudi. When you have a system like that, you cannot make peace, and you cannot make a state. I think that the only outcome of this situation is to build a secular democratic regime. Now, we think this is impossible. Look at the Arab world. It's all in blood and in religion. Yeah, of course. But look at Europe in the 17th, 18th centuries. It was in blood and in religions, and now they became seculars. Now they are coming back to their origins, stupid origins. But the only way out, not only for Lebanon, the only way out for the Arab Levant, which is an outcome of what was good, which is very rare in the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was a tolerant empire with minorities. And this is why we have minorities. In Europe, they don't have minorities. I don't want to go back to history to tell you about Spain, what the Reconquista did to the Muslims and to the Jews. We are societies with different confessional, with different religious sects, which the only way out from this, and these religious sects are not ethnicities. They don't have their own languages. They don't have their own culture. They don't have their own food. And they don't have their own dialects. They all speak the same. The only way out from this is the struggle for a secular society, which looks now impossible. But I think, imagine, now everybody speaks about Iraq, that, you know, Shia, Sunnis, etc. What happened in Iraq when Mr. Bush Jr. Decided to get rid of Al-Qaeda, so he sent all the Qaeda to Iraq, to the Iraq. This is what the idea was, that Iraq was working with Al-Qaeda, right? And was having mass destruction weapons. There was nothing of the two things. After the American invasion, now Iraq is a bastion of the Islamic State and of Al-Qaeda. What they have done, they have destroyed the state, dissolved the army, and made a election law based upon confessions. Imagine this in the United States, what will happen? No state, no army, and then a foreign power will impose on you to elect according to ethnicity and to religion. Of course, the United States will collapse. Any country will collapse. It's not a specificity for the Arabs.
I want to thank all of you for coming tonight. I think this has really been a great discussion.
Thank you.
In a number of different directions. Please join me in thanking our speaker and our commenter. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a reading and conversation with Ilyas Khoury, Global Distinguished Professor of Middle Eastern and Arabic Studies at New York University. Tonight's moderator was Jocelyn Cesari, Professor of Religion and Politics at the University of Birmingham, UK, and Senior Research Fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center on Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Our discussion was presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe and co-sponsored by the Institute for Iraqi Studies, the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations, the Middle East and North African Studies Program, and the literary journal AGNI. We began with an introduction by Boston University Professor of Anthropology and International Relations, Dr. Richard Norton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archive editions of this and all other programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarn and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.